25, Khandapali versus Director, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. Let's just wait for everybody to shuffle out of the room. Almost. I guess this is not the main event, but we're very interested in what you have to say. Mr. Banyas.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Brad Banas. I represent the appellant, Varsha Khandapali, in this case. This court should reverse the lower court's decision and remand it for further proceedings because the plain text of 8 CFR 214.14D2 requires the appellee, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, to consider, at a minimum, and issue parole travel documents to members of the U visa waiting list who are overseas. And for that reason, this court should rule in our favor.
Your request, though, seems to be only for travel documents, not for issuance of a parole.
Your Honor, that's exactly right. There are two different things being conflated here. There are the travel documents, and then there's the actual parole decision at the border. The best example of this in the record, Your Honor, is on page 15 and 16 of the reply brief, where we see the actual document that we are requesting, which the Department of State calls a boarding foil, CIS calls parole, lots of different words here. But I do think you're exactly right, Your Honor, the specific thing is a travel document.
Before we get to that question, can I just ask about the jurisdiction? Right, so we have the provision that says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, regardless of whether the judgment, decision, or action is made in removal proceedings, no court shall have jurisdiction to review any other decision or action of the Attorney General or the Secretary of Homeland Security, the authority for which is specified under this subchapter to be in the discretion of the Attorney General or the Secretary of Homeland Security. The subchapter is Title 8, Chapter 12, Subchapter 2, and that includes the provision by which the Secretary of Homeland Security issues a parole decision. Secretary of Homeland Security may accept as provided in subparagraph B, in his discretion, parole in the United States temporarily under such conditions as he may prescribe only on a case-by-case basis for urgent humanitarian reasons or significant public benefit any alien applying for admission to the United States. Isn't that pretty straightforward that the jurisdictional bar says regardless of whether it's made in removal proceedings, if it's in the Secretary's discretion, there's no jurisdiction, and the statute expressly says in his discretion.
Your Honor, if my client was standing at the border seeking a decision on parole at the border and was denied, I would completely agree that that decision at the border under 1182 D5A would not be subject to judicial review.
Okay, so do you agree that to the extent that you're asking for parole, there would be no jurisdiction?
We are asking for travel documents.
So that's why I started with that question. Why is that not a discretionary determination that falls under the provision that Judge Menasche just read?
The travel documents, Your Honor?
Correct.
Because they are not a creature of statute at all. They are nowhere referenced in the Immigration Nationality Act. They are a creature of regulation under 8 CFR 214.14.
But a statute has to be a regulation has to be based on a statutory authority, right?
Of course, Your Honor.
So if there is no statute that's the basis for the regulation, then the regulation is invalid, is it not?
Your Honor, this is based on 8 U.S.C. 1184P specifically. And if you go through the notice and comment rulemaking, they, tether all of the authority for issuing the waiting list to the statute, Your Honor. And so we don't doubt their statutory authority.
The waiting list, right, that's about the statute that authorizes the U visa program and then has a cap. And so that, leads to the idea of a waiting list. That may or may not be an implication of the statute, but that's a separate question. But the regulation that you're trying to enforce here is about the granting of parole to people on the waiting list, right?
It's about the granting of travel documents.
Well, the regulation itself says parole.
That's fine, Your Honor, but
right?
USCIS does not
have authority. That's fine. I mean, that's just what it is.
USCIS does not have authority to make a parole decision at the border because they have no authority at the border. That's strictly Customs and Border Protection, who are not a part of this case, have nothing to do with it.
But isn't that an end run around the jurisdictional bar to say you're talking about a travel document and not parole here?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court in Kukana in 2010 said that's not an end run because they said it has to be a statute and it has to specify the specific action. The waiting list parole, as we call it, or travel documents more specifically, is nowhere in the statute. So there can be no statute that deems it discretionary.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, so, you know, your client went through this one time, right? They said, we've conditionally approved your application for parole. You should go to the consulate. We're going to make sure that you're eligible to be on the waiting list and eligible for parole. And then she was issued a document that said that she's been approved for parole, and they described her as a parole beneficiary, right? So the document, you know, gives her parole.
No. The document is a travel document. The document allows common carriers to sell her a ticket, allow her to get on a plane in Hyderabad, go to the border somewhere to port of entry in the United States, and request to be physically into the country without being legally admitted. That's what parole is. Physical entry.
To request that. So you're saying, so if USCIS issued to your client a document that said, we authorize Ms. Kandapali to take a plane to a port of entry, at which point she should be required to return home, would that satisfy the lawsuit here? Would that provide the relief you're seeking?
Well, USCIS doesn't have the authority to say no to parole. So it would have, if she got to the border at Customs and Border Protection and they looked at her and said, no, we're going to deny you, we would get all the relief we wanted in this case. That's correct, Your Honor. There's three ways.
But if USCIS, I mean, USCIS doesn't believe she's eligible for parole, and you agree that there's no jurisdiction over a parole decision. So if USCIS says, all right, we'll give you a travel document, but we're also going to say that you're not eligible for parole. If she had a document that said she can take a plane and meet a, you know, official at the border, but the document will also say, in our view, she should be sent back immediately because she's not eligible for parole. You're saying that's all the relief you're seeking.
The document we're seeking, Your Honor, rather than speaking the hypothetical, would be identical to the one on page 15. It's a boarding FOIL. It gives her a one-time opportunity to get on a common carrier and go to the border and then seek parole under 1182 D5A. These are two very different things. The parole decision would be on the next page of my reply brief, where it's a stamp and gives a amount of time that you can be paroled into the United States. These are two wildly different concepts.
But they're not wildly different things, because you're saying you're supposed to get the travel document pursuant to the regulation that says that the USCIS is going to grant parole, right?
It says
the basis of your claim is there's a regulation that says USCIS is obliged to give parole to somebody who meets the circumstances of my client.
I think,
and like this travel document thing is not reflected in the regulation or in the statute.
I think it's two different things, Your Honor. I think they're obliged to consider the request. They are refusing to consider the request.
They're not, right? Because they said, we'd like you to fill out the form to apply for parole.
Your Honor, that was in an email with an assistant United States attorney based out of Vermont. I wouldn't call that USCIS's authoritative position. USCIS's authoritative position.
I mean, you know, also, I mean, looking at the document that you keep talking about on page 15, it says explicitly on the face of it, Holder has been granted parole authorization by USCIS for 1 year. Like, this document,
it's not a momentary,
reflects a grant of parole,
yeah.
Right?
That
like
means
the idea that you're saying this document means you just go and ask for parole, but somebody might deny it. Like, if I have a document that says I've been granted parole authorization, you're saying that does not mean that they've actually granted parole?
That's correct. Because if Ms. Kandapali was found in the United States with this document, having circumvented a port of entry, her status here would be unlawful and she would not be in parole.
But why would she circumvent a port of entry? She's got this card, because she can come into JFK.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. I'm trying to distinguish
the
question here.
Ask this question? If I think that what happens when USCIS gives this kind of a document to a parole applicant is that the person becomes a parole beneficiary and therefore is granted parole, then you would agree that we don't have jurisdiction over this case. Your argument turns on the idea that this document that says holder has been granted parole authorization does not mean that the holder has been granted parole authorization. Right?
No, Your Honor, because they haven't considered the request. They said, we will not consider the request. They point us to a form that has no opportunity or ability to apply for waiting list parole under 214.
I mean, if there's no, it's a, but the request is a request for parole, right?
The request is a request for travel documents, Your Honor.
Yeah, I understand, but my question to you was, if I don't buy the idea that this travel document that purports to grant parole is in fact something different than a grant of parole, then there's no jurisdiction.
Your Honor, no, I disagree, because there's still not a statute that says 214.14d2 parole is a discretionary benefit. It would also completely eliminate...
No, but the there is a statute, right? Because the statute that by which the agency has the authority to issue this kind of document is the statute that says that the secretary may, in his discretion, grant parole.
Your Honor, there's also a statute that says they have the discretion to implement rulemaking, but that discretion alone doesn't render this benefit discretionary. That is not a specific under 8 U.S.C. 1152 A2B2 as interpreted.
You know, so the argument you're making is that, you know, an agency can constrain its own discretion.
Absolutely.
And that's true, right? We have the Accardi principle that says that when an agency adopts a regulation that constrains its own discretion, like, that's binding on the agency. But the problem for you is that the jurisdictional bar does not say that you have no jurisdiction over a decision that's discretionary under the statutes or regulations, right? It says we have no jurisdiction over a decision that's specified under this subchapter to be discretionary. So the statute says it's discretionary. The way the agency implements that discretion is it constrains its discretion for some cases and maybe not for others. But the jurisdictional bar asks us to look at what the statute says.
And Your Honor, I see him over time, if I can answer.
Yeah, sure.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. The first thing is, we also have two other arguments. 1252A2B2 doesn't apply. It doesn't apply to unlawful withholdings. It only applies to actions or decisions. I would point the court to the Fourth Circuit's case in Lovo, where it goes through a nice text structure and history analysis of those two terms, action and decision, and basically says we can't interpret those to mean inaction and indecision. It has to be an affirmative.
But the agency is not engaged in indecision. The agency thinks you're not entitled to what you're asking for.
The agency,
and they told you so.
The agency,
right?
Refuses to consider our request, Your Honor.
Right. They don't. They didn't just fail to act. They said no.
They're not doing
what you asked.
They gave no consideration. I don't have a final agency action I can really challenge here, right? Because it was an email from an AUSA. Because contrary to their own positions that they reported to Congress and to themselves less than 10 years ago.
You don't have a final agency action, so does that mean we have no jurisdiction for another reason?
No, Your Honor. 5 U.S.C. 7061 gives this court jurisdiction, not a cause of action to consider unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed agency action, which is what we pled
on. Okay, so we have a final agency action under the APA, which is an action unlawfully withheld, right?
The APA indeed defines agency action as...
Okay, so the agency decided we don't want to give you what you want, and then you're suing them for agency action unlawfully withheld because that's a final determination for the agency that they're not giving it to you.
Your Honor, the APA definitions are different than the definitions of the words in 8 U.S.C. 1252A2B2. I would point out, like Lovo...
I'm not sure that they're different because often we do think that... not acting when you have a duty to act might itself be an action. But regardless, you know, we have all of these other cases from other circuits, including that opinion by Frank Easterbrook that says, well, even if the agency has decided not to prioritize this or not to act on it and it's leading to a kind of delay, that is an action related to the granting of parole, right?
Your Honor, we seek parole under the regulation. The statute doesn't mention it at all. There's no statute that deems this discretionary. In fact,
I don't know why I keep saying there's no statute that deems it discretionary when I read you the statute, right?
That deems parole.
The Secretary of Homeland Security may, in his discretion, parole the United States an alien applying for admission to the United States.
Applying to admission to the United States. That is a term of art under immigration law. 8 U.S.C. 1101A4 says that is someone at the border asking to come in.
Is your client not applying for a U visa?
My client applied for a U visa in 2018.
Is that not an application for admission to the United States?
It's not.
What is it?
It's an application for a visa petition. That's what the INA...
If she got the visa, would it entitle her to enter the United States?
She would, yes.
So you're saying even though she's applied for a document that would admit her to the United States. She is not applying for admission to the United States.
It's a fundamental concept in immigration law that admission is different than the basis for the visa. A U visa has certain requirements. Admission has a different set of requirements. There are two different analyses. 1252A2B2 is often used in this to highlight this distinction in the adjustment of status. We don't talk about the immigrant visa, or we can challenge an immigrant visa denial. We can't go after adjustment status because it's discretionary. Two totally different analyses. Ms. Cohen,
somebody applying for an adjustment of status is thought of as an applicant for admission.
That's exactly right. That's the equivalent of standing.
Might be in the United States and not even at the border. So like that just undermines what you just said, which is that an applicant for admission is only somebody standing at the border.
It's an exception to someone standing at the border. That's why we have the adjustment of status statutes, why they passed it in 1952. It's also why they passed the parole statute in 1952 when they created these inadmissibility grounds. But Ms. Kondapalli applied for her U visa. There's not one available. The appellee has said...
Okay, but if you're... since this is the only statute that authorizes the secretary to grant parole, and you're saying your client is not an alien applying for admission to the United States, doesn't the statute mean that the secretary has no authority to grant your client parole?
No, Your Honor.
If you were right about the premise that she's not an alien applying for admission...
I am right that she's not an alien applying for admission because she's not at the
so
border.
By what authority would the Secretary of Homeland Security be authorized to grant parole to her if she's not, doesn't meet the requirements of the statute that authorizes the Secretary to grant parole in the first place?
So once she has her parole travel document issued by USCIS, which is the, all it can do, she would then go to the border and then they would engage in this discretionary analysis. We're at step one. We're not at step two.
But that travel document is simply a logical prerequisite to the discretionary determination. Isn't that barred under the same jurisdictional bar?
No, Your Honor.
You can't rely on some aspect of a discretionary determination that may or may not be discretionary to claim that the ultimate determination is not discretionary.
They're two totally different analyses, Your Honor. This one depends on whether she is eligible for a U visa, but a U visa is not available at this time. Mm-hmm. That's what entitles her to parole.
Okay, so why is she in... Wait, entitles her to parole?
Travel document, Your Honor.
Okay, so what entitles her to the travel document?
8 CFR 214.14D2 and the
U.S. And what does that regulation say?
It says USCIS will grant deferred action or parole to petitioners and qualifying family members while the U-1 petitioners are on the waiting list.
Okay, so it doesn't say anything about travel documents. So what is the regulation or statute that entitles your client to the travel documents?
It's that regulation, Your Honor.
Why? But you're saying that you're not saying it entitles her to parole, which I would think is the more straightforward understanding of the regulation. You're saying it entitles her to something that's not mentioned in the regulation. So your interpretation of the regulation is it says USCIS will grant parole. That does not mean that USCIS will grant parole, but it implies that USCIS will grant travel documents.
Your Honor, that's a
very weird interpretation of that language.
That's USCIS's interpretation. When you get it
over... What? I mean, I kind of don't think that that's what the government is going to say when they get up.
When Ms. Kondapalli sued the government for the first time to get the initial grant of parole, travel documents... they turned over a boarding foil just like this. This is how they interpreted it.
And the boarding foil says, holder has been granted parole, right?
For 1 year. What that means is when she gets to the border and
CBP... Well, I mean, the statute says you could only grant parole temporarily, right? So, like, if there were not a time limit, then it wouldn't be authorized by the statute.
That time limit is up to CBP. If the officer at JFK wanted to only authorize parole for 6 months... That would be fully in their discretion, and they could do that.
So you're saying
no,
if somebody shows up with this document that says holder has been granted parole authorization by USCIS for 1 year, the CBP officer at the border says, I don't care. I don't care what USCIS did. I don't care what it says on that thing. It's my decision and mine alone to decide whether I'm letting you into the country, and I'm just going to send you back.
That's correct.
All right.
That's the discretion that 8 U.S.C. 1182 D5A protects from judicial review, and that discretion has no role in this case.
All right, well, you've reserved time for rebuttal, so we'll hear from you again, but let's turn to the government. Mr. McCroskey.
Good May it please the court, Joshua McCroskey, U.S. Department of Justice, on behalf of Appalee, Director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. The district court's basis for its jurisdictional holding is contradicted by Shia v. Bondi, and that settles the question of whether 1252A2B applies to USCIS decisions outside of removal proceedings. Granting parole is a discretionary decision. Therefore, the court and the district court has no jurisdiction to consider the claim, and the judgment should be amended to dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Now, on the jurisdictional piece, I want to jump into a few points that were just discussed in the opening argument. The first is the idea that, are we talking about a travel document or a parole? And the answer is yes. We're talking about both. There is no distinction between a travel document and a parole. What Ms. Khandapalli clearly wants in this lawsuit is the same thing that USCIS gave her in 2023, which is conditional approval for parole.
Right, and the condition in 2023 was not conditioned on a CBP officer at the border saying you can come in. It was conditioned on her going to the consulate and confirming that she's eligible to be on the waiting list and eligible for parole, right?
I think that's part of it, Your Honor. It is also true that CBP officials at the border could also consider eligibility for parole, but that's a double screening feature.
Right, so if she did something that either they didn't know about at the consulate or that it occurred after she got this document, then an officer at the border could say, I've determined you're inadmissible for some other reason, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But after that, absent that determination, since CBP gets its own input, but this document is a grant of parole by USCIS.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's
and Judge Menasche's question was asking if something came up after CIS issued the FOIL, whatever it constitutes, that CBP could say, hey, you issued the FOIL on the 1st and on the 10th she committed a crime or something, we discovered something, that they could deny it. Is it your position that CBP could deny entry and or deny parole without finding new information that would have been unknown to CIS at the time the FOIL was issued? Just simply because they're exercising their own discretion.
Your Honor, as a matter of the statute, I believe that's correct. As a practical matter, it would be CBP relying on new information. But both decisions are discretionary parole decisions, both USCIS's decision to grant parole and then CBP's actual decision at the border.
So they both grant parole and they have their own concerns. So which agency is the one that determines who is eligible for a U visa and to be on the waiting list and to get parole by virtue of that status?
That's USCIS, Your Honor.
And so CBP wouldn't normally be evaluating those criteria at the border.
Correct, Your Honor.
So this document says, in the view of USCIS, this person is eligible, on the U visa waiting list, is eligible to be there, and therefore has been granted parole by USCIS.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would also point out, Your Honor, that in USCIS's regulatory preamble adopting 8 CFR 214.14, it specifically references its statutory authority at 8 U.S.C. section 1182 D5A in reference to parole. It defines parole and the Secretary of Homeland Security's authority to grant parole as coming from that statute. So there's no separate regulatory basis or separate statutory basis. It all comes back to the same discretionary statute.
But granting a travel document and granting parole may be one step and then the next step, but they're two different determinations, aren't they?
Your Honor, they're not two different determinations.
They're not decided at the same time.
CBP and USCIS's determinations are at different times, but they're both parole eligibility determinations.
So you're saying they are at the same time, right? Would USCIS ever grant somebody a travel document that it was not granting parole? Does USCIS ever do something like, say, I'm giving you a document that allows you to travel to the border, but we have not determined that you're eligible for parole?
I'm not aware of anything like that, Your Honor. It's USCIS determines they are eligible for parole. That's why they're issuing the documents cited and shown in the reply brief at page 15 that says, approved for parole.
Right. So the idea that there is another, you know, an officer of a different agency that has its own responsibilities that might deny you entry once you arrive does not mean that USCIS has not granted you parole in its discretion.
That's correct, John.
Okay, let me ask you about the idea that an agency can restrict its own discretion, right? So even to the extent the statute would make the grant of parole for U visa waitlist members discretionary, the reg then, 214.14d2, says USCIS will grant deferred action or parole. So there, the agency is saying, even if it started as discretionary, we have now determined that it's not discretionary. We are committing that this is no longer discretionary. We're making it mandatory. How, if at all, does that change our analysis?
It does not change the analysis, Your Honor. The Supreme Court 2 years ago in the case Buarfa v. Mayorkas, that's 604 U.S., page 6, 2024, it discussed that 1252A2B2, in that Congress did not make the availability of judicial review dependent on agency practice. What matters is what's
practice in the statute. Is different than a regulation, though, right? That makes perfect sense. That sort of what we've been talking to about practical realities of CBP and CIS and how they intertwine. But that agency practice is, does that mean promulgated, formally promulgated, and adopted regulations? Is that what that statement from the Supreme Court means?
That was not the precise issue in Buarfa, but it would cohere with both the reasoning of Buarfa and the reasoning of the Supreme Court case it cites, Kukana v. Holder.
I mean, I don't know if you have to say that as an abstract matter, it couldn't be that the regulation might affect the jurisdiction. So if, in fact, the jurisdictional bar said there's no jurisdiction to review a decision which is discretionary pursuant to the applicable statutes and regulations, then if a regulation made it non-discretionary, we'd probably have jurisdiction to review it. But the statute, in fact, says we have no jurisdiction to review an action, the authority for which is specified under this subchapter to be in the discretion of the secretary. So, like, the provision is telling us to look at what the statute says, not the regulation. I mean, it's not impossible to imagine a statute that took into account the regulation.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's the reasoning in Kukana, where it talks about Congress sets the limit on federal court jurisdiction. And so the executive branch cannot then further limit the judiciary's jurisdiction. And I would argue it works in the other direction as well, that when Congress has said there's no jurisdiction here because the authority specified in the statute to be discretionary.
Right. And so, in fact, you know, the agency has constrained its own discretion against the backdrop of the idea that there's no judicial review over this class of decisions. Maybe if the jurisdictional bar was not so broad, it might have taken a different regulatory approach. We don't know. But, like, it makes sense that, you know, they might have constrained their own discretion as a matter of their own practice, but still expected it not to be subject to judicial review pursuant to the bar.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, I would go back to what this case is actually about, which is the specifically a parole decision. And even on plaintiff's reply brief, the very first paragraph, it asks this court to remand with instructions to the lower court to order appellee to issue Ms. Condepalli waiting list parole.
Let me ask how you could challenge. So the regulation says will. So a federal agency has declared, we guarantee you, we will grant either deferred action or parole. So in this case, we have this dispute about while and whether the one grant was enough. But there is a guarantee that at some point they will grant parole or deferred action. Let's say they say no, even to the first attempt. So this while question is not an issue. Is there? Are you saying there's no way to challenge that anywhere?
I don't know, Your Honor, what theory plaintiff may come up with to try to challenge that, but it's not what this case is.
Well, it is at some level. It's a challenge to, you know, there's a regulation that says we will do this. So if we assume for the sake of argument that plaintiff's right about what while means, then And so that it means that the will means that the agency was required to grant parole throughout the period of the waiting list. If we assume that for the sake of argument, then what avenue does she have? Where can she get relief if the agency, let's say the agency declares, we understand the regulation says this, we hereby refuse to follow it. Like, what avenue does she have? How can she challenge it?
It may be that there is no avenue, Your Honor, and that's something this court discussed in Shia. That's something the Supreme Court suggested in Patel. When the parties said to the Supreme Court in Patel, look, the broad reading you're giving to 1252A2B could potentially foreclose all these discretionary USCIS decisions that are made discretionary by statute, the Supreme Court didn't back away from that. It said that that may be true, consistent.
Well, there might be, right, judicial. So like, so 1252A2D says nothing in subparagraph B or C, which includes the jurisdictional bar we're talking about, which limits her limits judicial review, shall be construed as precluding review of constitutional claims or questions of law raised upon a petition for review. I know that this might be asking a lot, but if Ms. Kandpali thought that she really was entitled to come to the country, she could show up at a port of entry and seek entry, and then to remove her, they'd have to put her in removal proceedings, and that would be reviewed on a petition for review to the extent that it raises legal claims, right?
If she were placed in standard removal proceedings, yes.
Right, so there is a savings clause for when the same question arises in removal proceedings.
Only in a final order of removal, though, right?
Yeah, petition for review from a final order of removal.
Yes, that's right. And as a practical matter, as an applicant for admission, she would likely be placed in expedited removal, and there may not be that judicial review available. But again, when we're talking about...
But there would be a removal order, right?
There would be, Your Honor. But again, the point of the Supreme Court in Patel and this court in Shia is that when we're talking about discretionary relief, Congress made the choice to reduce procedural.
Right, so that's the other point, which is, right, so Congress says it's the Secretary's discretion and you don't get to review the Secretary's exercise of the discretion. The Secretary exercised his discretion by constraining it in certain circumstances, but the regulation could have just as easily said, not will grant parole, but you know, may in his discretion grant parole to people on the U visa waiting list, and that regulation would also be valid, right?
That's correct.
Right, so it was a discretionary choice of the agency to sort of give parole to a certain class of people, but that itself, you know, is a decision that Congress regarded as discretionary and therefore not subject to judicial review.
And the Supreme Court talks about this in Buarfa. The majority opinion there discusses that agencies should not be penalized by imposing consistency on itself. We hope agencies act in a consistent manner. And so when it's making decisions against this backdrop of no judicial review, the court should not then come in and say, oh, well, you've set standards for yourself, therefore you've
opened
up. Well,
I don't know about that. I mean, the whole point of the Accardi principle is that when an agency constrains its own discretion, that's binding on the agency and it has to comply. So in the absence of the jurisdictional bar, I'm not sure we would say, you know, well, the agency is doing its best and there's no judicial review. But like, your argument depends on the jurisdictional bar. I don't think you need to say, as a general matter, when the agency constrains its own discretion, you never get to hold it to that.
That's right, Your Honor. I don't mean to make, and certainly this court does not need to make a broad holding on the precise, you know, facts of this case and the issues before the court. It's the simple matter is that Ms. Kandpali is alleging that she's entitled to parole. She wants to get it through a judicial action, and that's something Congress said courts cannot do.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. McCroskey. We'll turn back to Mr. Banyas on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of quick points. One, you can't review a USCIS visa determination or parole determination in removal proceedings. The fact that my colleague said the wrong answer there, I won't hold it against him, but that's fundamental immigration law. That's
wait, what's the wrong answer? So yeah, so I guess I didn't appreciate the nuance. So maybe if you're an expedited removal, you wouldn't have the same petition for review. But whatever, the scheme says to the extent that the same issues could arise on a petition for review, you'd be able to review it and maybe it wouldn't.
This is not reviewable on a petition for review,
right?
Period. Because it's a USCIS determination and immigration judges don't have jurisdiction to review visa decisions, period. So that's simply wrong. 1252A2D provides no aid to my client ever. Second, my opposing counsel admitted that border decision and consulate decision are two different processes, different things. When you asked, Your Honor, if there was no new information after they got the boarding FOIL, could they still turn them down at the border? He said, under the statute, yes. And I agree with that. A decision saying that a boarding FOIL guaranteed you admission to the United States, entry to the United States, would eliminate significant swaths of Customs and Border Protection
authority.
But
why does it have to entitle you to enter for it to be a decision to grant parole? So why can't it be that the Secretary of Homeland Security says through the USCIS, to the extent that I'm exercising my responsibilities that USCIS is responsible for, I am granting you parole, notwithstanding the fact that there's going to be an additional review from the responsibilities that CBP has as to whether you are entitled to parole under those criteria as well. But that doesn't mean that there aren't two decisions to grant parole.
Your Honor, authority for parole and the parole decision are different things. Let me point you to the regulation 8 CFR 212.5F. This is the regulation that was enacted in 1965, I believe. Because the problem, Your Honor, and this is in our reply brief, was that people were showing up to the border with no visas and just saying, hey, we want parole. And so it became incumbent upon the district directors at the ports of entry along the border to deal with all of these parole decisions. And so then Immigration Naturalization Service, legacy agency, promulgated this regulation that allowed the agency to issue a travel document for people who were, quote, authorized for parole so that there could be some antecedent analysis. And so when USCIS promulgated the regulation we're here on today, they authorized parole that then through 212.5F
says when parole is authorized for an alien who will travel to the United States without a visa, the alien shall be issued an appropriate document authorizing travel. But the premise of getting the document is that you're authorized for parole.
And that's exactly what it says, you're authorized for parole. But that doesn't mean when you get to the border, they're going to make the decision to let you in. They can say no.
So your point is 212F, by talking about the authorization for parole and the issuance of a travel document, suggests that those two are different determinations.
That's what's going on here, Your Honor. That's what's happening. That's the travel document regulation. Mm-hmm. So when 214.14 refers to parole, it's authorizing parole that then is vindicated through 212.5F through a travel document. Because you cannot
abroad. So in order to be entitled to a travel document under that provision, you would have to be authorized for parole.
And
so you're saying that part of the relief you're seeking must be that USCIS is obliged to authorize your client for parole, right?
And issue the travel document. And in fact, USCIS doesn't issue.
Why isn't authorizing your client for parole an exercise of discretion under 1182 D5A?
Because that's discretion at the border. This is discretion under 214.14 D2, which was pointed out is absolutely mandatory. Will grant. There's no discretion admitted there. And they tied their own hands by doing this. And I think...
But that doesn't require the issuance of the travel document before the discretionary determination of parole.
Could you
ask that? It's after. I mean, the way 212.5F reads is that the travel document must issue after parole is authorized.
Parole is authorized,
mm-hmm.
And so then they get the travel document.
Yeah.
They take the travel document, they go to the port of entry, whole new ballgame.
But if parole is not authorized, 212 is not triggered. 212.5F is not triggered.
So I guess our theory is that when USCIS makes a waiting list decision for someone who's abroad, under this regulation, they have exercised their discretion to say you are eligible for a waiting list, therefore you get parole. You get a parole travel document because we have just authorized parole for you. We can't make the parole decision. And in fact, the way this works...
So what are they doing when they authorize parole?
What are they doing?
Yeah.
They USCIS in the United States issues a memo called a parole authorization memo to the Department of State. The Department of State then calls in the person for an interview, confirms their identity, confirms that they haven't done any crimes while they've been out of the country, and then issues the travel document. If we had a record in this case...
You're saying an authorization of parole is not a granting of parole.
That's right.
So what is it? It's just like a pre-approval?
Essentially, yes. It's authorizing them to get on an airplane, go and sit.
And why does the USCIS have the authority to issue a pre-approval? Isn't it also because of 1182D5A?
No.
So where does it come from?
It comes from 214.14D2 that says we can authorize parole. Once they authorize parole, because they're not at the border and they don't have authority under 1182D5A to make that decision, the work of 212.5F comes in and they issue a travel document. I will say, there's a lot of criticism about 212.5F and whether it is unmoored from the statute. The agency hasn't raised that question, so I don't think it's before this court. But if this court issues a decision saying when CIS or the Department of State issues a boarding FOIL, they're paroled in, that's amazing. That means every non-citizen with parole in the world, regardless of what happens, could just enter the country. That can't be
what Congress authorized. Right? You said the USCIS makes a decision to grant parole and CBP also makes a decision.
Then another way to say you would be expanding their authorities well beyond what they claim they are. And again, I will just end with this. We don't have a record in this case. Everything my opposing counsel is saying is a litigation position. We don't know what USCIS passes off to State Department. We don't know what their actual position is. In 2016, they said they were obliged and required to do this. And now they're here saying the opposite. And so in a 12B6 argument, where we get down to the substance, we need a record. And I think that would also assist with the jurisdictional analysis here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Banyas. The case is submitted.